So let's see. I had a pretty vague title. I'll try to make it more specific as we go along. I'm at RIT, and my background is in applied control theory. So most of what I'll be presenting is from that perspective, but because that's where most of we were asked to focus on work in progress. So I'll certainly be able to give you some work in progress. But if time permits, I'll get into some more mechanistic ventricular fibrillation related work if we have time. Okay, so they gave me a stick. Maybe I'll try this the old fashioned way. My advisor really hated in grad school laser pointers. He said the jitter made him nervous. I don't know if they have noise canceling laser pointers now or if this one. Anyway, so these are the two main topics intended. So first I'll talk about some control theoretic stuff and then time permitting via forecasting. So I've been thinking about bicycles lately because I'm riding one for the first time in over 15 years. So this isn't related to my work, but I found out over the weekend that a lot of people are working on modeling and controllability of bicycles. So this is to introduce the concept of controllability if you haven't seen it before or thought about it very much, using what I hope is a simpler model. This introduces some of the notation. This is work by Schwab and his collaborators. So most of what I'm going to be talking about assumes that you already got to this place mathematically in your description of a system. So you started out with a system of ODEs or PDEs, and you linearized it about some state of interest. And for example, a linearized set of ODEs could take the following form. So x dot is equal to ax plus bu, where this x is called the system state or system state vector. And this is a collection of all the variables that are of interest to you that you think are necessary for describing the status of your system at any given time. And one of the many available bicycle models incorporates these six variables, which I was told are phi is the rear frame roll angle, theta is the upper body lean angle, and delta is the steering angle. So so rear frame roll, I think, is coming out of the slide in this direction, upper body lean, and steering is the input you're applying at the handlebars. And for this model that they were analyzing, this term U refers to the control input. So this is what you're doing to the system to try to get it to do what you want. And the two that they considered were the steering torque and the body lean torque. So this is a model of perturbations around a condition that you do want, which is upright, steady, forward motion. So what this model encapsulates, what these system states encapsulate, is deviations from that upright, forward, steady position or trajectory. So in this linearized model, usually A represents the Jacobian evaluated at about the state we're linearizing about. And they were saying, the authors here were saying that the eigenvalues of A, so I'll be talking about eigenvalues a lot, represent different types of motions like weave, capsize, and caster. And yes, go ahead.
Is the state that you're linearizing about, is it a fixed point?
I think it's translational, so it's a constant velocity motion in the upright position, so you're moving forward. So it's not fixed relative to an observer standing on the earth, but yeah, it's I'm not sure what frame of reference they use for the model. I'd have to check that. So it could be analogized to a fixed point or just a trajectory, a very simple solution of the model where you're not falling over, you're just moving ahead at a constant velocity and nothing interesting is happening. So it would be a solution x as a function of t where some variables, let's say What are these?
So,
yeah, I think you can zero all these out, and that would still, there's nothing in here that that accounts for.
It's strange to see the dots also, but if, you know, mm-hmm. if it's a fixed point, it's a fixed point, it's time independent. If it's a limit cycle, then linearizing around that is a kind of a Fock-A block type of calculation of mm-hmm. linear stability. So just trying to see what kind of general things you're considering, but it will become clear in the talk.
It was a force balance model, or maybe they used a Lagrangian method to produce the equations of motion, but so there were second derivatives in, I think this is called the I forgot the guy's name already. They didn't develop the model, but they were borrowing a well-known model for bicycle motion. So the fact that there are first derivatives, I was thinking that's consistent with a second order model. This is a momentum balance and not just a kinematic model. But I do have the paper somewhere if people would like to read more about bicycles. It's not, I am not the best person to answer questions about these models, but I just thought it was an interesting analogy and had short state vector. Yes.
Before we move to the next slide, will you explain the controllability, mm-hmm. the concept? Is it just the list of the control inputs, or is something?
I had a little more on this slide, just in words. Yeah. So this top part is not specific to the bicycle. It's not the most exact. There are more than one definition of controllability, but approximately, we could say a system is controllable if we can always find an input. So that would be u as a function of time in the previous slide. So a time history of our input steering, our steering torque angle and, or no, or, yeah, our steering torque and our lean torque as functions of time that transfers the an initial state, any initial state to any final state in finite time. So we have to be able to get from point A in the state space to point B in the state space through appropriate choice of a trajectory in U, the U variable, which was back here. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'll be also referring at some point to the controllability with respect to eigenvalues that we could try to decompose our linear.
This A here
yes.
is the same as matrix A on the previous slide.
Yes.
It is typeset in a different way, so I wasn't sure.
Oh. Thank you. Well, I'm sorry. This was produced in a tremendous hurry, so I didn't have time to go through in. Yes, this was intended. I hope that font and typesetting aside, that capital A will refer to the same thing, or that you can get it from context if it's the word A. This is still the Jacobian from the previous slide, and we could refer to various modes or eigenvalues of this Jacobian as being controllable or not, depending on whether we can move them. So let's say, just to go further with this analogy, these eigenvalues of the Jacobian, they could represent different motions, but these could be stable or unstable. Fixed points, or stable with respect, or unstable with respect to certain directions in the state space. So, for example, I think they had both stable and unstable cap size eigenvalues. So there's an eigenvalue or a combination of eigenvalues that represents tipping over. That's capsizing. And so a stable cap size mode would be that I think you start to tip over, but then you recover. But unstable, you just continue to fall over onto the ground. So in some cases, having these modes, if they're stable, or these eigenvalues, isn't necessarily an emergency situation where you need to take appropriate action. It'll just fix itself. But in the case of instability for these eigenvalues, you do need to do something to keep from falling over or getting in an accident. So so we can talk about also controllability, and I haven't explained how to measure these things yet. But we can establish measures of controllability to try to or there are various established measures of controllability to try to answer this first question, can we get from point A to point B in the state space? And also whether, for example, we can choose our input U to convert, say, an unstable eigenvalue to a stable one.
Be correct to understand that A is a matrix of linearization, therefore it depends on the actual coordinates. So it's different in different points of the phase space. And that's what you mean by moving it. It's by achieving different points
yes.
of the phase space where these have different values, right?
I believe I agree with you. So for example, if we could consider taking our control input that we're actually monitoring the system state and choosing it as a function of the system state, then we end up changing the linearized dynamics if we consider a linear part of this control. And so in that case, we're looking to, I don't know what their eigenvalues look like. I mean, they had graphs of them, this would be. So if we have the imaginary part of their eigenvalues and the real part of their eigenvalues, then the stability in this boundary in this case should be the imaginary axis. So they're trying to move, say, let's say in the absence of taking any action, you don't steer, you don't lean. There's a cap-size eigenvalue out here. But if you take appropriate action in the form of choosing U correctly, could we move this eigenvalue over to the stable side?
Yeah, by choosing different X.
Well, X should be dictated. It's a solution to the system of linearized equations. So given we choose U, we specify U as a function of time, or in this case as a function of X, which is itself a function of time. If we're doing feedback control, we choose our actions based on our perception of the system state. Then X as a function of T is a solution to the system of ODEs for a given initial condition.
So Laura, I didn't mean to distract.
Okay.
I really wanted a very simple answer. So very simple.
Okay.
So
sorry.
Do I understand right that A matrix uh-huh. is a function of X?
A matrix, it's a linearization, so we're taking a specific X that we're linearizing about. So here A is evaluated as a specific X.
Yeah, so it is a function of X, yes or no?
The Jacobian is a function of X. A is the Jacobian evaluated at a specific, as wherever we're linearizing. So A is equal to DF.
A is a function of X, the all the other values are functions of X, yes or no?
The eigenvalues of the Jacobian, which I didn't include a notation for, that's where I'm trying to make a distinction, so if we replace this with df by dx, yes, those the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix are functions of x.
So to move or
yes.
to change the eigenvalues means to change the values of x in such a way that you achieve those desirable values. That's the only way of doing it. Or there is something else that I'm missing.
I think what I'm visualizing here, and perhaps should have put on the slide, is that I'm going to try to stick to my guns here, that that we're taking A to be a specific evaluation of this Jacobian. And so this, once we do the linearization and the evaluation, that it wouldn't be appropriate to say that A is changing just as X is changing. So in my mind, if we...
This form is a function of X naught.
Yes, yeah, that I'll agree with. And for our standard state feedback, if we choose something that's, in a sense, proportional to the system state, then the uncontrolled eigenvalues are the eigenvalues of just A. But if we add in this input U, then the eigenvalues of what I would call the closed loop system are this one. Does that help?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not eigenvalues of A, it's eigenvalues of A minus B.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, I'm getting ideas of where the blanks are. Okay. So So anyway, at the end of this this paper that I was looking at on bicycles, so they were comparing these different inputs and saying that they concluded that the unstable modes were more controllable according to their measure of controllability through the steering torque input than the upper body lean torque. And so I think their message there was not that you should never lean when you're riding a bicycle and only steer, but just relatively speaking, that you're getting more bang for your buck, according to their measure, more stabilization through the steering torque. And perhaps better analogy to what I was going to show later would involve a bit more apples and oranges comparisons, where in this case, for example, the inputs are both torques, but we can easily have cell models or system models where the inputs don't necessarily have the same units or represent the same type of intervention. So any other questions about controllability? Because I'm just assuming that most people have in the room have not worked with it directly, so it's not, there's no point in me talking about controllability results if I don't try to explain it first. Yes?
So there are many ways to control the system, right?
Yes.
Yes,
yes. I mean, because of this, which I should have put on the slide, is that so controllability is you can think of it as a measure of connectivity between your input and your A matrix. So how the inputs feed through the B matrix, which is the input matrix, into the A matrix in some sense. So how does your input affect your state, or does it affect your state? And you can try quantifying that. And those A and B matrices, those are from a linearization of a model that you chose. So an ODE model or a PDE model, ODE in this case. So to the extent that your model captures what you think are some universal properties, then you could try to generalize. But that's one of the things that we're working on with AP models, is that trying to figure out how model specific our answers are. Is that okay? Let's see. All right. So I might need to add some other things just in chalk, because I didn't copy over much information about, again, how we measure this. But I was just trying to think a somewhat bigger picture, but making it more relevant to less relevant to bikes and more relevant to the types of models that many of you may be working with, is that we could ask, for example, which input out of some list of options is the most effective at suppressing an unwanted behavior, such as alternance. And and various researchers have contributed to answering this second set of questions. So where and when should you be applying these inputs, and maybe those take the form of electrical stimuli, for example, to maximize controllability, to achieve control over your state, get rid of alternance, achieve something that you want to achieve. And I apologize if I left you out of this list. These are some of the controllability studies I'm aware of that comment on control of alternance. If I try to generalize this to, say, Bloss and Land's work on fiber control, I wouldn't consider that's a control study, but not controllability. So if I'm leaving you out here, it's not in a malicious way. Let's see. So what I wanted to get to is some of the ongoing work or work in progress. But this is a bit of older stuff. Just to give a simpler example, looking at a Lance 2-variable model, I don't think we necessarily need all this notation here, but just a reminder that there's a fast variable and a slow variable, or a voltage variable and a refractory variable, V and N. And a long time ago, I looked at some aspects of this model when it was in an alternance mode, and the controllability of the linearizing basically about this type of alternans trajectory and or a period one trajectory, and seeing whether we could bring the system back into a desired state. And the main formal analysis we did back then was
Laura.
Yes.
Peter, sorry.
Yes. Yes, sorry. It's
a constant or function of time, or function of time and space, or what?
Okay, yeah, I suppressed too many arguments here, perhaps. Yes, so this is, yes, so the refractory variable in the one-dimensional case, so we have V and N as functions of distance along the fiber and of time, and this I should be indicated as this could be a function of space and time. I only looked at a formal analysis at in the 0D case, so it's just a function of time.
Just time. Okay.
Yeah.
No delay variable.
No, we just considered, I guess you could say, an instantaneous control. So we're constantly feeding current into the cell, or continuously. So. Yeah, let me introduce this. So this is this was intended to be a drawing of. We use the superscript D for desired. So we consider the stand-in for the true system to be this top model. So we just no decorations on the V and N. So this is just the original system of PDEs, which we just reduced to the ODE case. And the target system has this superscript D. So this, for example. So the scenario we're interested in is the actual system is alternating, and the target system we produced a period one trajectory. So we want to go from alternans to not alternans, but we're looking at different solutions to the same set of differential equations. So this one being an unstable period one solution, and this being the long range behavior.
So why does the actual system have a control current? If it's alternating, it's not in control, right? So
this is, well, we're applying the current here. We could break this down into two terms. This I superscript D would just be a square pulse train. So we're using this to stimulate the system. And so we're considering, could we add some kind of perturbation to that square pulse train, this I tilde, to get rid of the alternans?
So the square pulse train is I.
Yes.
And is that given every place in the system?
We looked at the results I was going to summarize are just for 0D, so there's no. We got rid of the diffusion term and just looked at a single cell. We did some empirical studies back in of the 1D case, but not a formal controllability analysis. And in that case, I think that our results are superseded by those of the later results from Roman's group. But we were just looking at, for the fiber geometry, applying both the pacing current and perturbations to it at one end of the fiber. So just in one location.
I'm confused.
Okay.
In a normal system, you're pacing periodically?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
So there was a... Yeah, so there was a slide somewhere that didn't make it in my Dr. Frankenstein cobbling together of results from various presentations. But the pacing pulse or the stimulus pulse should just be a square pulse train, a periodic square wave. So ID looks something like this. Is that so? In the 0D case, we're just applying it to the cell, and in the 1D case, we're just applying it at one end of a fiber.
Okay.
So launching action potentials from there.
Is the object going to be to change the timing between short pulses
The object would be to take this ID and add to it. I guess we used a negative sign contribution. So this I tilde is what we're considering to be the control input. So we're adding on top of this, or subtracting from it, if you will, some other signal. So this this I sub D, we're going to find or look for an appropriate. This could be anything. We assume that some perturbation that's riding on top of the square pulse train. Well, if we want to keep things in the linear regime, we would hope that everything stays small, the I tilde and deviations from this period one trajectory. This isn't actually what I'm showing, a small deviation from a period one trajectory, but for the linear theory to hold, we would want deviations from period one and from this how we're driving the system to both be small.
What would be the I tilde for this example?
So the controllability analysis doesn't, we haven't specified anything yet. You can do controllability analysis without saying what I tilde needs to be. So it's more of a question of whether there is a relationship to a specific control method, but you can look at basically the coupling between these A and B matrices independent of what you say that U is. And so...
Now, in this specific example, it looks like the cycle length is almost the same, right? The frequency of pacing is almost the same. Or is it
these are meant to have the same cycle length.
Yeah, it's just cycle length, and what kind of I tilde would you use?
So we ultimately used what's called a state feedback, so something that is, so where I tilde is equal to minus k times x, where k, for example, would be a row vector, x is a column vector, so you get a scalar perturbation that you add to the current. So so the linear theory says that if, for example, if this system is controllable from this input I tilde, then you can find, and vice versa, a value for this gain matrix K that will move the closed loop system eigenvalues to wherever you want. So in linear regime, you can achieve control over all the eigenvalues through that choice of input.
But you're fixing the Bayesian rate. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The Bayesian rate is fixed in the...
Yeah, so it's not meant necessarily as a direct adjustment to the timing of the pacing. The pacing rate is fixed.
You're just
adding a perturbation to that pulse train. Does that make sense?
Are you going to show some ideas?
Let's see where this leads to.
Yeah, let's see what they
do. Oh, okay. Okay. All right. So, a summary of what we did is that we linearized about the Karma model 0D. Two variable dynamics about a desired trajectory, and got a model that was in this form. And just for a single cell, the state vector would be just the two variables in the cell. If you have a fiber geometry, you can discretize and add more VNN variables for more cells. So just to give an example of a simple scenario, we could ask this question of, so we computed controllability Gramians, which I didn't define here, but I can do that on the board. So we computed a specific measure of controllability, Gramian singular values for two different scenarios. So perturbing the V dynamics, so that would be this scenario that I was describing here, where we add a term up here to the differential equation for V. And we considered another scenario, which I didn't write out here, is, well, what if we tried to add a perturbation term to the dynamical equation for N instead? And so In the linearized system, those could be represented by different choices of this B matrix. So in the first situation, you're injecting this I tilde perturbation term into the V dynamical equation. In the second case, you're perturbing the N dynamics. And the results we found, it depended on the time scale over which you say you're applying the control. But if you want to try to achieve control over the system over a short time frame, then we found that perturbing the refractory variable, the N variable, directly, that was giving us a stronger measure of controllability, or larger controllability measure, when the time scale of the control input was short compared to the cycle length. And it's not that you couldn't necessarily achieve control through perturbing the V dynamics. It just, there was only a short window near the upstroke where this this perturbation variable was affecting both the voltage variable and the refractory variable. And I thought it was interesting. It's not necessarily the best news, because this N variable is lumping together a whole bunch of different quantities, right? So the more practical scenario is the one where this first one, where we're injecting a current and affecting the voltage dynamics directly, versus the second scenario where we're doing something that affects the refractory state of the cell, but we're doing it very quickly. So it was less clear to me what that would be. So this is some older work, and I do have graphs, but I don't know if they actually clarify, because they involve a lot of explanation of minimum singular values, which I was trying to dodge, but I'd be happy to show you later.
Can I just ask you a question?
Yes.
So this control of, mm-hmm. of alternance, mm-hmm. is can be understood very intuitively at the map level, at the level of restitution curve.
Okay. Yes.
You know, simple coupling,
right.
construction, where you add a feedback to stabilize a fixed point. Do these perturbations can be linked to that?
Yes. I think that would be more like this, yeah. this first scenario, where you're, if you just have APD as a function of DI,
right.
and then you add a perturbation to that type of map, then I would offhand think it's more like this first scenario. There's not less of a direct encapsulation of this type of dynamics. Maybe I'm wrong. I think others, Carolyn Berger, or there's somebody who did a perturbation analysis of probably more than one person. I don't know if Niels is in there somewhere. He perturbs everything eventually, so I don't know if he got around to that one or not, but I remember reading a paper by Carolyn where she was looking at different control scenarios. I don't know that she wasn't looking at controllability formally, but she started with the 0D map, considered time delay control and a bunch of other different scenarios, and looked at the impact on the eigenvalues.
Yeah, that has been looked at, the time delay control. Whether your analysis, which is more general principle, to do any kind of perturbation in space and time, whether that can be linked to the
Yeah, Niels and I tried, that we didn't publish that. I was talking to Xylin about that earlier. We did look at a coupled maps model. That was actually our first stop before your two-variable model, because we wanted to look at the controllability of the simplest model that we could find for fiber geometry. So we were looking at a coupled maps model that included both APD as a function of VI and CV as a function of DI. And it seemed that the controllability results for that version of the coupled maps model, they were unrealistically pessimistic. So compared to, say, the Hodgkin-Huxley style models, and also compared to the experimental results that were inspired by Echeverry and Karma's work. So there was, Niels wrote a white paper. It seemed convincing to me at the time, but I can't remember all the details. And Xylin was saying that we probably needed to do a better job of accounting for I think electrotonic coupling outside of CV to get realistic results. So that's something we could go back and look at, and I haven't checked in the meantime to see if anyone has followed that route. I don't know if Roman will be talking about it. He might. He has lots of other topics to refer to, but he and Flavio and Alejandro, right? There's a number of papers on controllability, formal controllability analysis for 1D, 2D geometries. So looking at controllability of eigenvalues and modes in those scenarios. So I think their results were, for extended spatial geometries, I don't want to misinterpret them, is that if you apply control all the time, continuously with respect to time, you don't need that many electrodes on a fiber to suppress multiple alternans modes. Okay, so just to note some work in progress so what we're looking at more recently is controllability of a single cell LRD model. We wanted something that had more realistic calcium dynamics, or more detailed, at least, calcium dynamics, and asking these same types of questions. And our preliminary results seem to be that if you had to pick one of the state variables, and there's, I guess, 17 of them for this version of Lurie dynamic model, some of the ones involving the internal calcium dynamics seem to be the most effective at maximizing controllability. And other ongoing work, which I don't have any pretty graphs for, at most I just have tables for these right now. I need a better visual representation, is how does controllability vary for voltage-driven versus calcium-driven alternans? So Elizabeth has some results from last summer showing suppression of alternans or not under different scenarios, and we're wondering if we can explain what she was seeing with her students in terms of controllability. She's agreeing, but I don't know if it's under duress. It's just.
You need an affirmation from
me. Okay, she provided an affirmation. So let's see. I'm not doing great on time. The ones where I had more actual plots to show were the observability results. And since I was obsessed with bikes lately, this is. One of my lab mates in grad school, I think, was working on a version of this thing. This was Berkeley's Ghost Rider motorcycle that was entered into one of the DARPA grand challenges. And so when you have an automated system, you have to think some more about what kind of sensors to put on it to get it to stop from falling over, going back to the bike analogy. So it was loaded up with all manner of things. It still fell over a lot, but there was the question of which types of sensors are the most informative. What do you actually need to be aware of all of the system state variables? And there's this other technical term that's analogous to controllability, is observability, is that we can say that the state of the system, whatever you think that is, of your dynamical system, is it's observable from a given measurement or output if we can reconstruct the state from a time history of measurements. So, of course, if you're building something like this, you do want more than one type of sensor, but you can ask the question of which is the most informative. And I'll skip some of these slides. You've probably seen optical mapping in a cardiac context, is that we can't measure everything that we want to measure, so how can we can reconstruct missing information? And so, let's see, moving on to LRD, is I listed out the 17 state variables of this version of LRD. And so our system state is this vector. And the control input, and I apologize for the lack of consistent notation here, where we're assuming in the single cell geometry, we're using the stimulus current to pace the cell to get it to fire. And has some examples of the equations. I didn't write out all 17 of them. One of the reasons we're moving to the Shifox model is that this LRD doesn't alternate much, and I think that's correct. It's not supposed to alternate much. So this is a bifurcation diagram, APD versus cycle length for out-of-the-box version of the single-cell LRD, and there's a little bit of alternans around 200 milliseconds. And so I had some students play around with some of the parameters. They made this envelope somewhat bigger. So if you want to study alternans, you can do that a little bit with LRD, but it's challenging. So I think I already had this on a previous slide, is that we studied the observability of LRD, and we looked at basically each of the state variables as a possible source of our measurement. So this is a summary of the single-cell dynamical equations. And here, instead of linearizing on the short time scale like we were doing with the Karma model, we were just looking at perturbations from one cycle to the next. So we were integrating the model over one cycle and identifying points along period one trajectory of the single-cell model. And if you're not considering a control scenario, then the linearized system looks a little different. J here is the cycle counter. We still have a Jacobian that maps perturbations from cycle J to cycle J plus 1. And then our encoding of the output is in this Y variable. This is what we're measuring. It's some C matrix times our state. And we were able to do an analytical linearization of the single-cell Karma, two-variable Karma model. We just...
Yeah, but with that delay,
right?
You say your current was only a function of space.
With the Karma model analysis, we were looking at like instantaneous application, so it was a short time scale. This one, I don't know how to do something analogous to what we did with your two-variable model. We would have to have a linearization about every point along an action potential as a function of time. So we were able to do that by hand with the two-variable model. Here, I don't know how to do that. We could do a numerical approximation, but linearizing about the upstroke is challenging. So it's easier to look at the linearization from one cycle to the next cycle. And it's mathematically more convenient because this Jacobian is just if we look at perturbations that are fixed relative to the cycle window to the same place within the next cycle interval, this A matrix is time invariant if we keep all of that fixed. So how much should I wrap it up soon?
10 minutes.
Okay. Okay, so, well, at least there are some plots here. So this is just reproducing the bifurcation plot for single-cell LRD. And just to give an example of, these are the magnitudes of the eigenvalues versus cycle length. So these two should be aligned in their horizontal axes. And this was consistent, this little blip of alternans. We found an alternans mode, so this is actually, since it's magnitude, the fact that this eigenvalue is real and negative isn't shown here, but it is outside of the stability boundary for a discrete time system, which is the unit circle. So we did find an unstable eigenvalue, or an eigenvalue corresponding to unstable alternans, but it's not that unstable. And it turns out that for LRD, there are also a couple of eigenvalues hanging out pretty much at the stability boundary. And from actual reading of the Lifshitz and Rudy's paper, this so there's a center manifold case, and it appears to be, just from our playing around with the full nonlinear version of the model, it's actually stable. It just decays or it converges to, so this is something that Neil's helped me with, the new steady state if you change, for example, the pacing rate over a course of maybe 10 or 20 minutes. And I think that's by design in LRD, according to the paper. That's what it's supposed to do, according to the physiology. But if you disagree, you can let me know. So these modes that seem to be stuck near the unit circle, I think they correspond. The actual center manifold dynamics is actually stable, but just very slightly stable. Okay, so. This is an example of modal analysis. You can do the same thing, or we did do the same thing for controllability that you can do for observability, is that, but the question changes a little of all the state variables, if we list off all 17, which of them is the most informative measurement for reconstructing the state? And this can be encoded in that C matrix that maps the state X to the measurement Y. So we can just take rows of the identity matrix one at a time to model different types of measurements. And then one standard measure of the magnitude of observability of the lambda sub I, the ith mode, from a given measurement k, the kth state variable, is it's the normalized dot product between this the C matrix and the right eigenvector. So if the right eigenvector associated with your eigenvalue is well aligned with the direction of your measurement in the C matrix, the more parallel these things are, the more informative the measurement is. If they're orthogonal, then you can't get information about that ith mode, that eigenvalue, from the measurement. And what did we find out here? Let's see. I think the upshot was that, how informative any given measurement is or isn't, it depends on the cycle length and which modes you care about. So the eigenvalues we generally care about are the larger ones. So this was saying that if our measurement is the intracellular potassium concentration, that things in lighter colors here, this is a plot of the eigenvalue moduli versus cycle length, and lighter colors mean stronger observability magnitude. And this other plot on the right is just kind of aggregating together the observability for the larger eigenvalues, this measure versus cycle length. So so it seemed that these larger modes are, or eigenvalues, are mostly associated or in the direction of potassium. And so measuring potassium is a good way to reconstruct those. But once alternand shows up, it's less informative. Whereas measuring the voltage variable gave an opposite scenario, that if you want information about the alternans mode, that measuring the membrane potential was a good choice. It gave stronger observability. So, and then there were some measurements that were poorly coupled to the state. So the D gate didn't tell us anything, really, except for very, well, no, this is 10 to the minus 6, so it was not informative about the state. What we're attempting to do now is some rankings of different state variables in the order of magnitude of the observability measure that we obtain from those measures, and just trying out different scalings and perturbations to the parameters to see how robust this is. So the current ranking is that overall cycle lengths, that the potassium variables seem to be the most informative, and membrane potential was somewhere in the middle. But we considered all of these measurements acceptable, except for things getting down below 10 to the minus 10th in magnitude, and those were the release current and the D gate. Yes? What's these two columns? Okay, so this is the base 10 log of this controllability or observability angle, averaged over the largest, I think, eigenvalues that have a magnitude above 0.9. So a larger number here indicates stronger observability. Okay.
So, try to reformulate the question. You have defined what that cost is.
Yes.
Is that related to any particular algorithm, how you're going to reconstruct the whole system based on these particular observations? And in that algorithm, this cost will play a significant role.
This is more, I would think, at this stage, just an offline. It's not something that you would necessarily be checking all of the time during an experiment. It's just we're just making an index of model properties.
Yes. Well, okay. Another way. This definition is it postulated, or is it a quantity that naturally occurs in some particular algorithm?
Mathematical perspective. Yeah. This is a well-established measure of observability, and you're right. I didn't show
who established it. Yes,
I can show you the derivation given enough time.
It is used.
Yes. So this was developed in the 1970s, and I had a citation here at one point, but it went into the ether. And so what it shows is that if you have the easier case is when all of your eigenvalues, so you have one lambda sub I eigenvalue associated with each of your right eigenvectors v sub I. And so if you do a similarity transform on your linearized system and convert it into the modal form, so you try to diagonalize your Jacobian, your A matrix, then you can find, you can determine that the whether or not the say the ith mode when you have a diagonal A matrix in this transform state space, information from that state actually reaches your output Y is determined by the dot product between the C vector and that eigenvector. And you can do something analogous, and this was again established at least in the 1970s in the same paper for controllability by looking at dot products between your B matrices and the left eigenvectors.
If you allow me to reformulate, so if I understood you right,
okay.
So this quantity determines how easy it is to reconstruct the actual state from the observation. And if this quantity is close to 1, then it is easy. When it is very small, then it is difficult.
Yes, so it, the larger this, right, the farther this dot product is away from 0.
The definition is between 0 and 1.
Yes.
Okay. When it's close to 1, it's easy. When it's close to 0, it's difficult.
Okay.
And it can be very, very small.
And then we'll go to the next slide.
Uh-huh. Next slide. Okay. Oh, the table. Okay, so here I'm. So log 10 of the average of these observability angles. So here I'm in coming up with sort of a heuristic. The individual observability angles, those are long established, almost before I was born, as measures of observability of a given eigenvalue from a given measurement. Here I'm taking an average of those angles, angle magnitudes, over the top several modes. So I filter down to eigenvalues with magnitudes above 0.9, just something close to the unit circle or outside it, because I only care about reconstructing the larger modes because they don't, they're the ones that contribute to the perturbation from one cycle to the next. So I'm just arbitrarily, I've tried out a few different measures here, taking the mean of these angles or their magnitudes, and then once I have that mean, I'm just looking at the order of magnitude of that mean here, so log 10 of that mean. Does that? It's not an intuitive measure. I'm attempting to lump everything together. If I wanted to pick something, this is one way I could choose. I'm not claiming that this is the best way to aggregate. It's just a way to aggregate. Yeah. So. Okay. To wrap things up here. Observability analysis serves as a guideline for designing algorithms, feedback algorithms that are analogous to the state feedback, is that we could feedback information from the measurements into a model in order to reconstruct the state. And it looks like potassium is particularly informative for LRD, but it's yet to be determined whether that's consistent with what other models would say. So cycle length is of course an important variable. And I didn't discuss here, but observability has close connection to Kalman filter design, which is a standard way of algorithm for reconstructing the state given a measurement. And if anyone, I don't think I have time for this part, but wants to talk to me about using a coupled maps model, this axis is not to scale, but to look at the lowest level of complexity to try to forecast ventricular fibrillation. We did a project on trying to validate this model against data from an optical mapping setup and showed that, well, we had very low expectations of this model and it worked better than we thought in terms of predicting a sequence of events connecting premature beats to ventricular fibrillation, that this model was able to capture some aspects of of discordant alternans, conduction block, and using conduction block as a proxy for VF. So we did a lot of statistics with help from various statisticians. I think the title of this paper is I Wish I'd Learned More Statistics Back in Grad School. And but it's going to show up in JAHA later this year. So I don't know if we have any extra time to get into that, but I think I'd better call it a day soon. Oh, it did? Okay. Well, if you're willing to, I can go through it a little more slowly. We have a whole bunch of talks today. How many talks do we have today? Okay. Well, that was a preview. Okay. Yeah. So the original hope outside of timing was that if you didn't like one project, you might like the other. Although you're free to dislike both. It was a joint paper. I should have credited the other guy. Rosenbluth and Wiener wrote a paper where this quote appears. So, okay. Well, I don't know who wrote that specific sentence, but you're right. I think I should credit both of them and not just one of them. I guess I was just thinking of Wiener due to the resemblance. If you've seen pictures of Flavio and Norbert side by side, it's interesting. Could you be the reincarnation? Is that temporally possible? So I could try to give you a quick tour of this one. So this was a project that was based on Neil's NIH grant back at Cornell. And just looking at the relationship between short sequences of premature beats, which have been observed in clinical settings to sometimes precede VF, and just trying to understand more about whether this proposed mechanism going from a type of discordant alternation to conduction block to reentry and so forth and degenerating into VF were present in the data, so you don't need to be told what cycle lengths are, probably. And this was a sequel to Anna Geltzer's studies. One of them was from 2008, where they tested different combinations of timings of premature beats, up to five of them, in vivo. And they were able to predict, using a coupled MAPS model, which combinations or interbeat intervals were more likely to lead to ventricular fibrillation. So all of the interbeat intervals here, all of these cycle lengths for S1, S2 through S5, they're following fairly close on to one another. So they're all types of different timings of different types of short or premature intervals relative to the S1 train that preceded it. So the coupled MAPS model is what it sounds like. There are variations on this model, but it combines CV and APD restitution. And with this model, you can generate what it gives you are the wave fronts and wave backs of each action potential, shown in gray here, with distance along a fiber. So this is just a 1D cable geometry, and time increasing along the vertical axis. So it tells you where the wave fronts and wave backs of each AP are going to occur. So it gives their evolution. And what you supply to this model are the interstimulus intervals. And so that's one version of the model equation. So we have APD, cycle length, DI, as functions of distance along the fiber. And in Anna's studies, they weren't able to look at, there wasn't enough information to tell whether block was occurring, for example, as predicted by the model that preceded VF. It was not possible to tell whether action potentials were, if there was any evidence of discordant alternans, for example. So those are various predictions of the coupled MAPS model that couldn't be verified in vivo. So we did the in vitro sequel to this study. And so this was just an example of that I was showing earlier is endocardium and epicardium with diforineps and with action potentials being launched from this point. And after five, that's the fifth one, premature beats, the we see maybe one or two loops of reentry and descending a descent into ventricular fibrillation. Yes. After, if I can rewind here, after the fifth beat, no. So this is the S1 pulse train, and then there were five stimulated beats.
Reverse pacing.
Yes.
And for what's your duty cycle for the
burst pacing? We're programming in the inner stimulus interval. So I don't remember exactly what they were, but we were looking for trying to achieve a short, long, short, short pattern with our S2 through S5 here.
So your burst pace was not a steady interval.
Yeah, so we're looking for, we classify these premature beat intervals into short, intermediate, and long. So they're all just variants of a premature beat interval. But by adjusting the timings of the stimuli to certain values above the ERP, so for this sequence, we were looking at maybe something like 2 milliseconds. They would have been 2 milliseconds above ERP, 50 milliseconds above ERP. That's the long one, and the short, long, short, short, and then two and two, something to that effect.
Can you show the film again and just...
Yes.
Hold on, before you show it,
yes.
Just say S1,
yes.
S2, S3, S4, S5.
Okay.
No, and then it's over, so we can just...
S1, S2, S3, S4, S5, and then no more stimuli after this point.
Well, your model presumes that you're going to have a stable spiral wave before the VL. I don't see it.
Our theoretical model did. I did make a reference to spiral waves. The actual computational model is a 1D coupled MAPS model, so at most it can represent, the pattern of stimuli leading to discordant alternans and conduction block. It can't represent any reentry because it's only a cable. It's an open cable.
But that's one, somebody tried to do it in S1S2 with some kind of 3D with fiber rotation.
There isn't. We can make comparisons between model predictions and data for discordant alternans and block, and that's it. Anything after that, the model has nothing to say.
Okay. But do you see discordant alternans before?
Yes, more often than not. I would say more often than not. So those were the subjects of our...
In burst pacing, they have nothing to do with it. They only...
Okay.
Burst pacing doesn't produce a discordant alternans or any alternans for that matter.
Okay. When I say alternans, I don't mean a pure period two rhythm, although I don't think that's what you mean either. But this is an example of the type of thing that we were seeing. So yes, a cable model. So this is another space-time diagram. So our measure of discordant alternans was to take we're first taking the distal APD and subtracting off the proximal APD along the fiber. So if there's no widening or narrowing of the action potentials that travels along the fiber, that difference between APD should be zero. And so this is distal minus proximal APD versus the stimulus index, 1 through 5. So this is S1, this is S2, this is S3, this is S4. And this is an example of a simulation where the S5 wavefront happened to block on the S4 wave back. So these are the types of predictions this model can make. Block or not block, alternans or not alternans.
There does not need to be alternans. It's not like you have alternans and then this S5, this sequence of stimuli can excite transient oscillation, but then ultimately...
Yeah, so and maybe I should say transient...
An alternant that's like three beats, presumably. That's not an alternant. That's not long enough to call it.
Okay.
That's just semantics.
It's an alternation, a transient alternation.
But you see, alternance has a very specific technical meaning right now in the business, where you can have short, long, and it stays that way for a while.
Yeah.
And that's a bad thing is going to happen to your heart if that continues. That's the technical term of
alternance. Okay, yeah, I can be more careful and not call it alternance.
The first part of your presentation, you talked about control, and you mentioned that refractory period control was the most effective way to correct for dynamic abnormalities. Am I correct?
According to the zero D karma model, yes.
You say a refractory period here.
Yes.
Control of refractory period. That's a sort of a broad term. Do you mean the duration of the next action potential, or do you mean the resting potential? Because if refractory period to you means that you recover back to a specific resting potential, that has a different meaning to me than if you simply say you terminate the action potential, but it can be a variable resting potential. Because if you come back to a specific resting potential, you stabilize and you reset all the channels. And that has a big implication about control. And that's probably what happens. If you just stop the action potential and you come back to a refractory period, irrespective of resting potential, that maybe, in fact, causes more abnormalities and instability.
To clarify what I meant by ERP is the way we were measuring ERP here is that we'd start out with a pulse train of 10 S1 stimuli. Then we'd bring in S2 at 250 millisecond delay after the last S1. And then we'd step down the S2 stimulus in decrements of 2 milliseconds until conduction block was achieved. We could no longer see that. So that's how we were defining the ERP. So we were programming in these premature stimuli at fixed timings above the ERPs that we measured in sequence. So we could achieve different patterns.
But now you have a condition where there are and you have some sort of perturbation. And controlling the ERP, you said, brings back stability to the system and reverses you back to the rhythmical state. One, I don't know the exact perturbation in your I-diddle that you have inserted, and I don't know what you mean by ERP in this case. How do you bring back ERP, or how do you control ERP to stabilize the system?
When Mark talked about controllability, he was talking about a refractory variable in a two-variable model. So a model that just had a multivariable and a refractory variable. And if he can control that refractory variable, and that may mean something like it in practical.
I don't know what she means by refractory variable. That's
so
what
it's
my
basically
question is.
If you have a very simple, instead of an ionic model, you have a simple model that's in two variables, one is a multivariable, and the other is called a refractive variable, and it basically has some sort of slow dynamics. It recovers slowly from depolarization.
It's a reduction of the normal model, so this N variable was a gate variable of the potassium current.
Of the what current?
Potassium current.
The potassium current. So for you, ERP is controlled by potassium current, and what are you doing to stabilize the system? You increase the current?
No, that's what she said. She can mathematically, control that variable, but it's very hard to. There's no simple implementation of that in a real tissue.
No, I understand that this is a Gedanken experiment.
Yeah.
I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah.
But what is the model doing? Is what I'm asking. Refractory period.
You're changing and you're influencing.
Because there's more than one way to skin that cat. You can change refractory period a number of ways. And so you're doing it in a specific way, and that's with the IKR current or IKR.
Okay. She's not aiming to control the refractory period, only the variable.
Yeah, I didn't mean to induce, to confuse the two types.
Yeah, let me ask you about this experiment. So uh-huh. Is the CV restitution that it was used in the 1D map measured from the tissue?
No, it was not. So we adjusted one variable in the CV restitution map based on actual measurements from each of these ventricles, but that was just DI min. So we took CV restitution was a function of DI min and a bunch of other stuff. So DI min we took from one per ventricle from the optical data, but all of the other parameters in the CV restitution curve were taken from the same ones that were used in Gelter studies. So we could have in this study we did not in any way try to I would say fine-tune this model beyond just basically calibrating these curves to each of the APD restitution curves to each ventricle. The CV restitution curves to get those from the optical data would have taken more work because we are missing a component of the velocity.
It's so difficult.
Yeah, so we would have to try to correct for that missing component, among other things, if we reduce the optical data. So it's, we tried to hold as many things fixed or do things in the same manner as Gelzer did. It's far from perfect, but yeah. So this was an earlier version of that. Is that let me show you a visual, and then there's some statistics. Which I think are best as. So this was an example of one of our best results. In the paper, we show that the best and the worst is that. So one question we had is if we pick a region, like average APDs and DIs over a region that's proximal to the stimulating electrode, and this is on an activation map of S5 on endocardium, and a distal region, that's this red square here, and pretend that this is a fiber, and then plot the difference, the delta APD, the distal minus proximal APD in red here, and the model predictions in black. Do they agree with one another? So this is this transient alternation that I'm referring to that we were looking for. So this is a very good outcome. So in some of the outcomes, the measurements look nothing like the model predictions. So we tried to tell, this is, so Neil stepped in and did a Bayesian analysis of these B2B changes in the spatial gradients of APD and DI. We were just looking for patterns because the model was predicting this plus minus plus, this alternating pattern of these B2B changes in gradients. And so our question was, is this happening more often than not in the data, or is the data just essentially random, like a coin toss, plus, minus, plus? And so what we found was that this plus, minus, plus alternating pattern was the predominant one in both the changes in APD and DI gradients. So we found that the signs of these means were more likely to follow that pattern, and perhaps I should not use the word alternance here. This is a transient alternation. So 91% of the time and 82% of the time for APD was 91, and DI was a little bit worse at 82 than would be expected if none of the patterns were predominant. So if we just had an unweighted coin toss in these patterns, we'd expect that any three-element sequence would occur with a likelihood of 12.5%. So that was one attempt at quantification. If there's an alternating pattern in the data, how do you tell? Because it's there sometimes and not other times. And some other tables that we found. That the models when the model predicted block tended to occur, so this is block actually occurring, and or block being predicted to occur and block not occurring for, according to the model versus this is a 2x2 table, and block being observed and not observed in the experiment. So when the model predicted that block would occur, we observed block in vitro. But when the model predicted that block would not occur, it was kind of a wash. So it worked in one direction. And we're not really sure why. It seemed that the model was overall just under predicting the amount of block we saw in vitro. Yes?
Do you know how the speed of the point is, if you have an isotropy feature or something? So could that be a 2D effect that we are using now one model as a coordinate?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there was definitely a directionality. I think this is along the fiber direction on the endocardium, this direction. And sure, there's all sorts of things that we didn't try to model, including, 2D effects and even in 1D, any form of spatial heterogeneity. It was not included in the model. So that was our top, I think, recommendation after looking over what model variables that we could vary to get better agreement, is trying to include some spatial heterogeneity in the cable model parameters as opposed to adjusting anything else. That seemed to be the best avenue, which we haven't tried yet.
Might improve.
It might not improve. It might improve. So I think I'd better stop. Yeah. But if you would like to talk or, you know, more, I'd be willing to and very happy to discuss any of this in greater detail. Thank you. Well, that could be part of the problem. Yeah, that was my harsh introduction to bench science. So it's not that I didn't respect scientists before, but I respect them more now. Yes.
One comment. So,
yes.
Very nice data. Thank you so much. But there are two questions here.
Mm-hmm.
So how inducible your tissue is, that's what you did. So that's one question.
Mm-hmm.
And another question is that does it predict? Or does it predict the sudden death in the future? And those are completely different questions, two different questions.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you're putting S5 to some tissue, and then in general, if you're sick enough to make it to the hospital and in the EP lab, I can induce VF in anybody if you put that down to S5. For example, if I take you to the EP lab and try to do this, I can produce VF. But most likely, you don't die of sudden death.
Okay.
So those are two complete
questions. Right.
We, back in the 80s and 90s, people have done a lot of EP studies on everybody, and then they go, great, this is how we predict the future, how we predict the sudden death.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when we were like cardiac electrophysiologists or like neurologists. We just do the testing, and they do nothing. But then now we do a lot of ablations and then do the EP studies, but then we do less and less EP studies because we know the limitation of EP studies these days. So we just have to recognize those two different questions.
Yeah, that's right. We didn't look at any, we were working in vitro, so the terminal outcome that we were interested in was just the induction of VF. And it seemed that those types of predictions for this coupled mass model worked better in vivo than they did in vitro. So the model did a good job of predicting when VF would occur in vivo. It did a better job of predicting when VF would not occur, like which patterns of premature stimuli would not were safe in vitro, and didn't do as good a job in vitro. And we think that maybe there's insufficient myocardial mass that we had in vitro to get as much VF. And I'm aware of
ischemia.
Yeah.
You have a lot more ischemia in vivo case that you're not going to have in the other case. Because when the heart starts to have electrical problems, it has mechanical problems, and the coronary perfusion falls. And so you have all the metabolic and complex changes that occur as a result of that. That's why it's very different.
Well, I think in the experiments of in vivo, they were tracking the pressure, and they didn't start the S1 institution until the heart was back to normal.
But if you did, then you would see changes.
Yeah, the fibrillate and the weight again. So,
well, that changes everything. That changes the outcome because the channels and transporters are not functioning the same way.
I was interested in your comment about relevance to clinical electrophysiology. So
And at the time of when people were trying to argue that the T-wave alternance test, you know, was predictive, they compared to a standard EP test, right, and look at the survival rate and so on. And for the standard EP test, I think these several stimuli to see how inducible, or even to decide to implant a cardioverter defibrillator. So what is actually being done in terms of if you wanted to test whether somebody, you know, is really at risk of sudden cardiac death, what's sort of the best practice?
The short answer is that it is EP studies too in the guideline, but there are a lot of studies that done back in the early 2000s, and then a general idea is that if you go to S3, that's okay, but if you go S4, S5, then your false positive rate goes up. For example, you tend to induce BF in otherwise healthy heart.
I see.
So we don't do further than S3. S3 is probably the last thing that we do. But
and how is the S1, S2, S3 standard sequence? How does it look like?
There are some standard sequence. S1 is usually 600, 550, and 400, or maybe down to 350.
I see.
And then I go down, and then we usually go down below 200 for S2, S3. Mm-hmm. So, again, the same reason. If you go below, not 190, 180 milliseconds, there's a lot of false positive, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can depend, there's a lot of fibrillation in an atrium and a ventricle.
So the question of how to design a test that doesn't have false positive.
I think that the idea, if I remember, the idea behind this project was not to try to predict what patients would be usable, but to identify sequences of stimuli to potentially avoid.
So this is presumably a healthy heart. I mean,
this is intended to be. Yeah.
And so they're trying to test.
Right.
Same idea, because if you go out down to S5, mm-hmm. you're inducing a lot of ischemia, right? Because you're piecing at the very, very, very tight coupling interval. So it's very short, but yes, it's a transient ischemia.
Yeah, I can't comment effectively on whether this can, you know, bring back some relevance of EP testing as opposed to what do they use, left ventricular ejection fraction? Is that more of a for diseased heart? Whether they get the implantable device, but this, we were studying healthy tissue here, and it was motive for this project was more, and I'd be interested to hear actual clinician comments on anti-tachycardia pacing. Our thought was that if there's room for improvement, this could help distinguish good sequences from bad ones in ATP.
We should,
yeah, well, I'm sorry, but thank you for your time.
Yeah, so let's take-